Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. Our guest today, formerly exonerated individual Jeffrey Deskovic, now an attorney and super strong advocate and co-founder of Foundation for Justice. Attorney Deskovic will be discussing a multitude of issues he encountered prior to, during, and beyond his unfortunate wrongful conviction. So without any further ado, we're going to welcome our guest, Jeffrey Deskovic, to tell us more about his experiences, both negative and positive, that has led him on this journey around the country to bring awareness while helping other wrongfully convicted victims of injustice to be vindicated. Jeffrey, are you on with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you once again for having me.
I want to welcome you. It's been a pleasure interviewing you. And for those who weren't on last week, I wanted to introduce you to them as well and have you speak on it. We also have on with us today Margaretta Taylor, and she is the wife of a wrongful convicted individual who went into prison in 1987, and he is wrongfully convicted. Unfortunately, there was no DNA. But Margaretta will also be asking questions and talking to you about her situation to learn more about how she can help her husband as well. Margaretta, are you on with us? I have her on. Margaretta, are you on with us? I don't know if she can. Margaretta? Sometimes we have problems with the sound. She'll probably come on. But Jeffrey, if you can start to talk about, anything that you want to talk about that led you to a wrongful conviction and what you encountered while incarcerated and all the things that you did when you came out to finally get to where you are now, which I have to congratulate you again.
Thank you. So, all right. So we'll start about, my case a little bit. So I did spend 16 years in prison. I got arrested when I was 16, and then by the time the trial started, I was 17, and I was wrongfully convicted of a murder and rape in Westchester County, New York, which I didn't commit, and ultimately I was exonerated after 16 years in prison through DNA testing that established my innocence while simultaneously proving the guilt of the actual perpetrator. So in terms of my case, I got on the police radar because the police interviewed a lot of high school students, and some of them told the police they might want to speak to me because I was quiet and to myself in high school, and so that's how I got on their radar. In addition, the police thought that it was my emotional reaction to a classmate that I barely knew, having been murdered and raped. They thought that was suspicious. And then they got a psychological profile from the NYPD, which purported to have the characteristics of the actual perpetrator, and I had the misfortune of matching that. So for about 6 weeks, they played this cat and mouse game with me, in which half the time when they talked to me, they would pretend like they needed my help to solve the crime. And when they would push too hard and I'd become frightened and I'd want to get away from them, then they switched it up. And Jeff is this junior detective helper theme was something that they played up. And I really fell victim to that because I was 16 years old. And before I was a teenager, I wanted to be a cop when I grew up. So, them asking me opinion questions and congratulating me that my opinion was correct and, making me the center of attention and making me feel important and stop in from time to time. So, in addition, they played the good cop, bad cop game where one officer pretended to be my friend. And, being as though I came from a single parent household, I began to look up to him as like a father figure. So eventually they got me to agree to take a lie detector test by telling me they had some new information in the file and they wanted to share that with me. And that would allow me to be more helpful to them. So the next day, rather than report to the high school, I went to the police station. My mother and grandmother thought that I was in school, so they didn't call around looking for me. And they drove me 40 minutes by car from Peekskill, which is in Westchester County, New York, to town of Brewster. which is in Putnam County, New York, so 40 minutes away by car, which meant that I wasn't able to leave on my own anymore. I was dependent upon the police. There were three officers who came with me from Peekskill, but there was also the Putnam County Sheriff's investigator, and he was dressed like a civilian. He was pretending not to be a cop, so he never read me my rights. He gave me a brochure explaining how the polygraph worked. It had a lot of big words in it, which I didn't understand, but then I thought, well, since I'm here to help the police, so what does it matter? Let's just get on with it. From there, and by the way, I had no attorney present. They didn't give me anything to eat. And from there, they put me in a small room and gave me countless cups of coffee to get me nervous. And then this polygraphist launched in. It was third-degree tactics. So he raised his voice at me. He kept asking me the same questions over and over again. And he invaded my personal space. So he kept that up for 6.5 to 7 hours. And towards the end, he said, what do you mean you didn't do it? You told me through the test result that you did. We just want you to verbally confirm it. And that really shot my fear through the roof. And then the officer who had been pretending to be my friend, he came in the room and told me that the other officers were going to harm me, but that he'd been holding them off but couldn't do so any longer, that I had to help myself. Then he said, look, just tell them what they want to hear. They'll stop what they're doing. You could go home. You're not going to be arrested. So being young, naive, frightened, 16 years old, in fear of my life, the fact that I didn't know where I was and that nobody else did either loomed very large in my mind. There was the push-pull dynamic of the possibility of harm and then this false promise. So I made up a story based on the information which he had given me in the course of the interrogation. By the time everything was said and done, I had collapsed on the floor into a fetal position, crying uncontrollably. And obviously I was arrested. I was charged with murder and rape. Before the trial, the DNA test result showed semen in the victim didn't match me, but the prosecutor got the medical examiner to commit perjury and falsely claim that he had remembered that he forgot to document medical evidence, which he said showed the victim had been promiscuous, which the victim's family hadn't been coming to court, so they had no idea what was being said about her in the courtroom. But that false testimony allowed the prosecutor to argue that she must have slept with someone else before I murdered and raped her, and that was why the DNA didn't match me. It wasn't because I was innocent. It was because she slept with yet another person. Taking it a step further, he mentioned another youth by name that he claimed had slept with the victim, but he never had DNA test results performed. He never called him as a witness. He just made the unsupported argument to the jury. Simultaneous to that, my public defender basically didn't defend me. He never called an alibi. He never called my alibi as a witness. He never tried to discredit that medical examiner. He never explained to the jury the significance of the DNA not matching me. He never used that to argue that it proved the confession was coerced and false. He should have never represented me with a conflict of interest because this other youth that the prosecutor was falsely saying had slept with the victim was represented by another member of that same public defender's office. And so that conflict prevented the defense from asking him to give a DNA sample or the defense from calling him as a witness. In terms of the confession, it was not videotaped or audio taped. There was no signed confession. It was just the cop's word for it. And so they left the threat and false testimony. I wanted to testify and add those facts, but my lawyer wouldn't allow me to. Sometimes my lawyer argued that the confession never happened. Other times he said that he argued the confession happened, but it was false, and it's still other times he argued that it happened but was coerced. So that type of scattershot approach all over the place, you know, he had to have come across as somebody willing to say anything. When you're defending a case where there's a confession, then, you know, you have to disprove that confession. You have to answer that confession. You have to explain it and bring it all together in your closing argument. But he didn't do any of that. And as a result of that, all of those things, I was ultimately wrongfully convicted and given a 15-to-life sentence because I had been charged as an adult, sentenced as an adult, and ultimately sent to an adult prison. And the judge sentenced me despite telling me, maybe you are innocent. You know, you would think that common sense would dictate if a judge thinks that a defendant's been wrongfully convicted that they would overturn the conviction, which, you know, the law provides that if there's a reversible error on the record that would be reversed on appeal, that the trial judge has discretion to overturn the conviction. But, you know, he didn't do that. He just took the easy way out.
You know, you just mentioned a lot of the things that we right now talk about as far as reform goes. First of all, your mother, your parent was not with you when they brought you to the police station, which was one reason why we look at the police as being deceptive. And I'll tell you, they were nice to actually, I have a loved one that went in when he was young as well. They were very nice to me when they were looking for him. They were, you know, so sensitive to the situation. But you just mentioned, well, people wonder why no one trusts the police. Because the police will say, we're going to help him. We know that he was seriously depressed. We know that he was, or in your case, we know that he was only 16 years old. They didn't allow your parent to be there. And they treated you really nice, trying to get information from you or trying to coerce you into saying something that you, or admitting to something that you didn't do. But these are all the things. You mentioned the judge. There's a lot of corruption in the courts. And there's a lot of judges that will be just as deceptive as law enforcement. You mentioned that. So every issue that you're mentioning, there are so many people out in the communities today, advocates, lawyers, politicians, that are looking at reform in the criminal justice system. But I wanted you to go. We have a caller, 813. Could you state your name, please?
Margaretta.
Margaretta, okay. Margaretta, you want to talk a little bit about your situation with your husband who ended up in prison on a wrongful conviction in 1987?
Yes. Good evening, everyone. I just want to say that my husband, as she said, has been incarcerated since 1986. He sat in the jail until March of 1987, and when they did his trial March 18th, on the 19th, the very next morning, when they took a break, the jury went out and came back in with the verdict. He was sentenced in June of the same year to 25 mandatory years to life. There was no DNA evidence. There was no physical evidence. There was nothing pertaining to his case to prove that he did it except the little girl's word against his word. And then briefly, three public defenders were on his case the same day. They got rid of two. The third public defender was called. And he, being a brand new graduate of law school, never done any trial not even a criminal case. He never went to the jail to see my husband. He never called any witnesses, and I'm glad the young man said what he said. His mother had hired a PI who had four witnesses that knew his whereabouts on that day in question. He would not call any of them, he said, because he wanted to go on the public defender, wanted to go on the credibility of the 11-year-old girl. She had been known to lie in school. She had been known to lie about anything. And being in prison for wrongfully conviction has really took a toll on my husband today. He is 66 years old. He went in at 33. And the day of trial, I don't want to miss this one, there were eight jurors on the bench, which six of them were white, two of them were black. And when they recessed on that same day, when they came back in, the two black were gone. And the reasons that they gave did not make any sense. One of them, even being sworn in at the beginning, one of them they had to get rid of for the reason he would not understand the medical terms that would be used by the physician that examined her. The second one, they had to let him go because apparently they found out that he had had a son who had been in prison, but they did not know it at the time, and they didn't feel that he would be fair, so that was the reason they removed him from the jury, but they never replaced neither one of them, so they ended up with the 6 all-white jury. And then, even speaking of the judge, the one that was supposed to sit the bench evidently was a true and just judge, because then in court they say he was not going to be able to come. They had already called a judge out of retirement, which I found out through the Florida Bar, they can come out of retirement in a emergency, but there was no emergency. And he sat the bench, and he is the one that was there that day. And then my husband ended up with 25 mandatory years to life.
There's so much corruption out there. And like I say, even with assigning lawyers to prisoners, there was a case where I found out after an attorney was assigned to a prisoner for post-conviction that the attorney was connected with the victim's family, and nothing was ever said about it. So these are the kind of things that don't make sense. And this is why I really welcome Jeffrey on the show to talk about these issues, because especially at 16 years of age. But in Margareta, in your situation, you said he was 33. Now, how long was the trial, your husband's trial?
The trial began on March the 18th at 9 a.m., and it was completed March the 19th, the very next morning at 10 a.m.
And Jeffrey, how long was your trial when you went to trial?
It was about approximately 2 weeks.
Jeez. Unbelievable. I've never heard of a trial lasting only one day or 2 days. I've never had. And when I think of the Chauvin case, that was seen by the world, and that lasted quite a long time. And there was such a difference in cases. And I wonder about these situations, because it seems like all these situations have affected so many people from the age of, and I'm sure there's been even younger than Jeffrey's case at 16. But what do you think of her husband's situation, Jeffrey?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the stuff that she said simply doesn't make any sense. There's a lot of irregularities there in what she mentioned, and certainly having a one day trial. I mean, I would comment, but I think it's kind of obvious I don't know that a comment is necessary on that.
Yeah, really. Jeez.
I know what you're trying to say.
Unbelievable.
Say this one, maybe a couple of other things, so that Jeff can also know that the judge, and I found out again from the Florida Bar, that he never came back to the bench anymore after my husband's trial. And then on the witness stand, the mother said that she never had reason to believe that Mr. Taylor bothered her daughter in any way. They picked him up from his apartment with no warrant, and he was picked up by the live-in boyfriend. I don't know if this is significant or not, but this is what happened. They picked him up from his apartment, and when they picked him up, it was the uncle of the live-in boyfriend to the little girl. The last thing is, when he went, when my husband went to trial, and he saw wherein that they had given him a incompetent attorney who had never come to see him, who never came to talk to him about his case, he knew then what was going to happen, that he was going to get some time. So he's talking to him, trying to tell him that my mom got a private eye. He has people who can witness to the fight where I were at this particular time, but the public defender would not call, neither one of them. So that lets me know that it was a done deal before they even went in the courtroom.
Yeah. Real quickly.
Yeah, a lot of times attorneys, I encounter a little bit of this even in law school, you know, in hearing philosophies of different law professors. I mean, there's a conservative school of thought, you know, in which, you know, lawyers, they don't want to put a defense on because then they're worried, well, then the burden of proof is going to shift from the prosecution to the defense, meaning that the jury is going to be, you know, looking for the defense to prove its case, whereas, you know, it's definitely harder. In theory, it's harder to prove, you know, to prove a case rather than, you know, that's just a whole, it's harder to prove something as opposed to, you know, just relying on reasonable doubt. And so, you know, lawyers do that sometimes, but I think that's one of those old schools of thought that really has gotten in the way of a lot of substantive justice, you know, to me, because, you know, you call witnesses to establish your own points. I mean, to me, that's, you're helping to create reasonable doubt. And, you know, you really have to shape a competing narrative in front of the jury, you know, and, you know, the jury is not thinking, I don't believe most jurors understand the idea of guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, or that the prosecution has to prove their case. It's not up to the defense to prove it. So I think it's a mistake to approach cases that way. And if you have evidence and witnesses that the defense can present, then I feel strongly that they should present them, but often they don't.
I have a question, Jeff. I know that you didn't know this at the time that you went to trial, but when they have a jury, I notice they always have somebody like at the top in that jury, somebody that's leading it.
The foreman, yeah.
Okay, can you explain something about that? Because I could never understand how that worked.
Well, that's just supposed to be somebody that's supposed to guide the discussion. You know, that would be like being a chairperson on a committee, you know, or you're the majority leader at a city council, or you want to be the Speaker of the House or the President of the Senate, just to give analogies. So that's just supposed to be somebody that keeps things moving around. You present issues, you know, just make sure that the conversation stays, you know, that the deliberations, you know, that you're continuing to talk about the case and, you know, throw the issues out there and everybody, you know, discuss. Just keep the discussion moving along. It's not that you're in charge of it or that your view is supposed to be the one, because, you know, the jury foreperson still only has just one vote, just like everybody else does.
I was just wondering, though, do the attorneys question that person, too, to see if that person is biased in any way or if that person...
Yeah, sure. Yeah, sure. They're vetted. They're supposed to be vetted just like you would any other juror. Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's what I was curious about. That I really was trying to figure out how that works, because I noticed it's like that in every trial with the different jurors.
Yeah. So I mean, but all right. So, you know, as we come in here, where anyone have a preliminary feeling where we're at? Or look, let's talk about. You know, there seems to be different opinions. So let's talk about this person's credibility versus that one. You know, let's start exchanging views on that. Or, all right, so what do you think about this and that? Or does everyone understand the law? Just ask general things and get, like, consensus and just facilitate the conversation, moving along. Not that you're trying to necessarily get everyone to come over to where their point of view is.
Yeah. So continue with what you were saying about your situation. I mean, how did it all come about that, you know, you finally started to see the light when people started to actually get involved in your case?
Sure. So, well, I mean, I lost 7 appeals. I think it would be educational just to quickly walk through that, and then I'll get into how I was exonerated. So the first appeal, my lawyer argued that I had a different lawyer, and the lawyer argued that the confession was obtained in violation of my Fifth Amendment rights, and the judge should not have allowed it in as evidence. She raised the issue that I was innocent based on the DNA not matching me. She argued that there was legally insufficient evidence to convict me, that the prosecution hadn't proven guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, that the verdict was against the weight of the evidence. She argued that it was an error for the judge to allow the polygraphist to keep telling the jury that I failed the polygraph, that, you know, that the law was clear, that the results were not admissible in the court, and that the judge was in error to create this backdoor rule where he allowed the polygraphist to keep telling the jury that I failed while preventing my lawyer from cross-examining him on his methods, and that it was an error. There was evidence admitted into the court, victim's clothes, and then the judge claimed that the custodians threw the clothes out over the weekend. So in all, there was like 10 issues of law. The appellate court ruled that the statements were voluntary, that I was free to come and go as I want. They wrote that there was overwhelming evidence of guilt, which is, you know, kind of a head scratcher considering the DNA didn't match me. And then they got rid of all the rest of my arguments in one sentence by writing that they looked at my remaining contentions and found them either to be without merit or not preserved for review. They ruled 5-0, and it was all downhill from there. The re-argument motion was denied in one word, denied. Court of Appeals declined to give me permission to appeal to them. I lost in federal court because my attorney was given the wrong information by the court clerk pertaining to the filing procedure. So the fact that my petition arrived 4 days late was deemed to be more important than the substance of the issues that was being argued. And then the Federal Court of Appeals upheld that ruling, and they declined to give me the re-argument motion, and then the U.S. Supreme Court declined to give me permission also. And so right there, that was 7 appeals, and now my appeals are exhausted. So that means that I'm permanently locked out of the courthouse unless I could find some new evidence, which would have probably led to a different result. So I had no money to hire. I had no money to hire an attorney or an investigator, so I was looking for someone to take my case pro bono, and so I began this 4-year letter-writing campaign, and ultimately one of those letters, I wrote a book author in care of a published company, but the publishing company sent it instead to an investigator. She wrote me right back right away, and she believed in my innocence based on the DNA, and then she tried to get people to take my case. So she suggested I write the Innocence Project again, which frees wrongfully convicted prisoners across the country where DNA evidence can demonstrate innocence where no prior testing's been done. And she lobbied them to take my case, and she got other respected legal entities to do that. And then I got lucky that one of the intake workers, who was not an attorney, when the attorneys didn't want to take my case because the DNA had already excluded me, she represented it several times, getting them to take it on the third try. So getting their legal representation was the first key. Second thing is Jeanine Pirro, who does commentary on television, she had became the DA after I was convicted but before the first appeal was decided. It was her office that had fought all of my appeals, and she had blocked me from getting DNA testing several times. So she left office, and her successor was willing to let me get the testing. And the third thing was we got lucky that the actual perpetrator's DNA was in the data bank. So we took the crime scene DNA evidence, which did not match me, and they put in the data bank, and it not only did it, again, not match me, but it matched the actual perpetrator whose DNA was in the data bank because he killed the second victim 3.5 years later as a result of being free while I was doing time for his crime. That lady was the second victim, you know, had the two children. So my conviction, DA agreed to overturn the conviction September 22nd, 2006, and I was released, and then I went back to court November 2nd, 2006, at which point all the charges against me were dismissed on actual innocence grounds, and that was how I was exonerated.
After 16 years.
Wow.
After 16 years, yeah. And seven appeals and the parole board denial because I maintained my innocence rather than expressing remorse and taking responsibility.
Wow. And may I ask you a question, Jeff?
Yeah, of course.
What do you think of this? The whole year that my husband sat in the county jail, it shows to me that they were trying to come up with a reason to put him in prison. And the reason why I say that is because the state ordered him to go to the clinic to take a penicillin shot. Okay, he was blessed to be taken there by a guard that was a Christian. He asked him to please stay in the room because I don't want to take a shot for I have not been tested for. Because it came up that the little girl had gonorrhea. When they did go ahead and test him and he came up negative, the nurse could not go ahead and give him the penicillin shot because he was not positive. So now all of a sudden, the little girl doesn't have gonorrhea now. So then they had to turn around and try to say he molested his girlfriend's six-month-old baby. When the little girl was in the, I think you call it the irrigation room, the mother wasn't allowed in there. Nobody but her and the police. And they were in there for hours. And the attorney that his mother got back in the years of 1992 through 96, she were told that when the little girl never said her son's name, she said every name in the court that was not her son's name. She called five different names. Now, my question is, what do you think of when the physician that examined her and on the witness stand, her exact words were, it is unlikely for this allegment in question to be been done on this date because when I examined her, her hymen was not broken. It was in full attack because it takes 7 to 10 days to be healed.
Question?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't, we need to know a little bit more about the allegation, but I mean, if the allegation is, you know, he made forcible vaginal penetration, but her hymen is intact. I mean, that doesn't add up. I mean, obviously he must not have done that.
She's 11.
See, at this point,
and he's 33.
No, well, look, a common pattern in wrongful conviction cases that have ended in exoneration would be when there's an alleged child victim, and when they grow up, they get older, sometimes they recant what they've said, and they explain, you know, why they lied, what they said. I mean, now courts are very skeptical of recantations, but if you can anchor that recantation to something else that, you know, corroborates that, then, you know, that would be a possible route of investigation. So at this point, remember, having been in since 1986, his appeals would have been over already by now.
They were.
So yeah, they're exhausted, right? So it's not about the issues of law anymore or anything irregular that happened at the trial. I mean, that might be a factor as to why somebody believes he didn't get a fair trial, or why somebody might not believe the conviction or might believe in their innocence. You might use that in trying to persuade someone to take the case. But as far as an actual ground for winning the case in court, pending exoneration, that's not where you're going to win at. I mean, you have to try to find proof of innocence at this point. So that means you have to identify lines of investigation have to be identified and then followed up on. But really the first step is trying to obtain an attorney or an investigator. So, you know, that means a really nice and tight letter with not more than two paragraphs in it has to be drawn up. You know, first line, my name is so-and-so and I am innocent. I was wrongfully convicted of. Mention the charges. Next line, you know, the evidence against me was. Mention what it is. You cannot leave anything out. Now, the next thing after that, the problem, the flaw in that evidence is, boom, and you mentioned that. So, for example, if someone was misidentified, so I would put the evidence against me was I was identified by one person. Next slide.
Uh-huh.
However, that was by a 78-year-old woman who normally wears glasses. This was 3:00 in the morning. She said she heard a noise. She got up. She looked out her window. It was pitch black out, and without putting on her glasses, she said she saw me from 500 feet away. So you see how I mentioned the evidence, and then I immediately said something to discredit it. So you put the evidence, what the evidence is against you, and then you got to answer and show what's actually flawed in the evidence. From there, you know, you would mention, you know, two or three facts that are already on the record already that point towards his innocence. Then you would mention something secondary. So, for example, you might use this juror thing, or if there's a statement from an investigator or an attorney, you know, stating belief in them, anything that would be secondary. And then you would mention any possible investigative line. And then someone's posting things and it's coming through the call. So then from there, you mentioned some potential lines of investigation. So when people get these letters, right, what you're trying to do, and I've written hundreds of them while I was in prison, and I've received a lot so at my foundation. So I know what they're supposed to look like. And the ones that are effective and persuasive, right, you're not trying to get people to take your case with one letter. What you're trying to do is you want people to see themselves after they've read it. You know, if what they just said is true, then yes, I could see how they might be innocent. So that's the thought you're trying to get through with this letter. And the next thing is the next question that your next question is going to appear in people's mind that you're really trying to answer in this letter is you're trying to show that this case is winnable, that there is a potential route to victory. And so even though it would be the lawyer's responsibility to identify what lines of investigation, what steps could be done to try to find new evidence, that's later once someone's taken the case. At the front end of it, when you don't have anyone taking the case, it's in your interest to show what steps could be taken, because nobody's going to take a case if they don't think that there's a possibility that they could win. And then you end up. The reason I'm contacting you is because neither I nor my family have any money with which to hire an attorney, and I'm hoping that you will consider taking my case pro bono so that I can prove my innocence. Right. I have legal documents proving what I said. However, I'm not going to send them to you right now out of respect for your time. When I hear back from you, let me know if I may send you some documents or what you'd like to see. And then you end the letter. That all has to be done like in two paragraphs. You got two paragraphs maybe, if you're lucky. No one cares about the case. No one's invested in the case until they actually are. So the more that somebody writes, the less likely it's going to be read. And the worst thing of all, other than writing lots and lots of pages, the worst thing of all is when defendants start sending a bunch of legal documents that are not asked for. That's one of the fastest ways to make people like want to like panic and run and get away from something. And it's all going to end up into the trash can. So never send documents. Never overwhelm people. Never send documents unless they're asked for. You have to keep the letter nice and short and sweet. This is going to be a process by which they're won over if it's going to happen. It's not all going to take place in one shot.
Right. Okay.
You know what I find with
helpful
with the universities around the country, I have to say, thank God for them, because the way things are going in this country right now, there's just so many people in mass incarceration, so many people in prisons, that the lawyers, the good lawyers, they're so overwhelmed, like yourself, Jeff. So overwhelmed with situations similar to not only the wrongfully convicted, first-time offenders, the people incarcerated for life and life without parole, for addictions, for mental illnesses. And thank God for these universities. And I want to bring this up because there's a lot of people, a lot of family members that are not aware that there's universities out there that actually help in cases of wrongful conviction and also help with cases of life and life without parole or other situations. And I never knew it until I became an advocate myself. But when my situation first happened, I was like green. I didn't know. Like you said, even with your mother, I'm sure your mother and your grandmother they must have been overwhelmed so much. You as a 16-year-old to be going through that is terrible. But as a family, as you and your grandmother, your mother, having to deal with this, a first-time issue that was so devastating. And in my situation, he was a first offender, and he got a life in life without parole, and he had never been involved with drugs. He never was involved with the law. He was in school, college, and everything else. Things happen, and it's overwhelming when it first happens to you because you don't know which way to turn. And this is why
I agree with that 100%. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say this is why it's so important that you are going around the country, that you are speaking about it, that you are on the radio shows on the regular basis like this, because you're going to be a blessing to so many families that don't know which way to turn, that are not familiar with how to go about things. You not only went through it, you came out, you got your master's, you went to college. You got your master's in criminal justice. How many people do that? But yet you went even further than that and became a lawyer. It's unbelievable. It really is. And it's good that it's a blessing that you did all these things, because you can be such a help bringing awareness to everyone and about what you went through. And there's a lot of prisoners in this country, a lot of incarcerated individuals who, like yourself, grew up without a father, in a single parent home with a mother, aunt, or grandmother. In my situation, it was myself and my mother that raised my son. And there's so many situations like that. And I will say another thing. A lot of kids that are raised by their mother and their grandparents usually come out very good. They learn a lot of the old-fashioned ways. They learn a lot of good things in their life. And to be incarcerated, either for something they didn't do or for something they did while they were seriously depressed. It's a shame, but these things happen.
No, for sure. And you are right that, there are law schools that do have clinics and take cases. But even if a law school doesn't, that's not to say that you couldn't, look up the law professors that deal with criminal law, that they practice in criminal law. And you could send the letters to them, and maybe they'll decide to do it on the side, or maybe they'll turn into like a class project or something that they work on with one or two students. Similarly, you know, what you would do from there in terms of once you have the letter, and by the way, everything counts in the letter. So you make sure that everything flows. There's no spelling errors. Punctuation is all on point, because no one wants to struggle and figure out like what is being said. So beyond that, you would then Google and just make a listing of what are the large law firms that have a pro bono section in it. And you would know that because that would be something that they would advertise on their website. So you'd look for large firms, you'd look for medium-sized firms, you'd look for a small firm, you'd look for solo practitioners that mention that on the website, or that there's a news report or something, a case that they did. And so you make up a list, and you start out with the large, and you go down the list, and you be systematic. You keep track. You know, what was the date that you contacted? What was the email address? Email address? And you follow up, and you make a list of firms that do not have a pro bono section in it. And you're going to spray that letter around all over the place, you know, start in your county, neighboring counties, ultimately, you know, statewide. And you might even think about like a border state that's near you. I mean, don't try someplace, you know, around the country. I mean, halfway around the country, but I would try I'm in New York. So, for example, if I was looking for help, I might consider to try certain firms in Connecticut or Jersey once I've exhausted the New York options. You know, so that letter, you're going to use that, you know, you would use that over and over again. And that would really be how it's done. But you could help. So someone on the outside, your family, a family or friend or loved one has a wrongful conviction case, you can help them in constructing the letter. You can send you can get the addresses and everything, but, you know, people don't realize that, you know, these firms and even nonprofit entities that work on these wrongful conviction cases, they only want to hear from the applicant. They don't want to hear from, you know, friends and family. I mean, that's a fairly common misconception. I mean, we get emails at my foundation. We get emails all the time where people are asking, you know, could you give me a call as soon as possible, you know, and that's really not how that works. The application or the inquiry has to come from the person who needs the help. Because what happens is, if we took phone calls from everybody, we would never get any work done, because everybody, you know, everyone wants to call. Everybody holds people on the phone for really long amounts of time, and they don't fully understand the actual issues, or they might get certain facts wrong. And, you know, that's why it's key that the communication is with the applicant, because, you know, when your case is being evaluated to determine if they're going to take it or not, you know, there's one of the things people are going to be in tune for is, well, is there anything in this letter, is there anything that the applicant has said to me that's contradicted by the record? And so that's another reason why it's really important that everything come from the applicant, because if you're friend and family member and you get something wrong, you know, somebody may interpret that, you know, as, well, they're lying about something. And who's lying? Is it the innocent person or someone who's guilty? So you wouldn't want the misinterpretation to happen that way.
Miss Leone.
Yes.
Right here, may I make two comments so that Jeff can hear this, what Florida is doing?
Sure. I'm going to say one thing, though. What Florida is doing is probably being done in other states. Unfortunately, every state is different, but the problems are usually the same. But go ahead and say what you want to say.
I'm glad Jeff said what he said, that they want to hear from the prisoners themselves and not the family members. But, Jeff, the problem we are going through right now is the prison, Avon Park, Correctional Institution, Avon Park, Florida. At that prison is where my husband is. Number one, we just had a public hearing this past Friday to where they are doing a proposed mail change, where now when we send mail in, they will scan it And you know when you scan, you can put in what you want to put in. You can take out what you want to take out. And the inmate may not even get everything what you're sending them that's dealing with the court. Number two, this is an issue to where now the guards are checking the mail before it leaves the dorms where the guys are. And if it's anything dealing with motions or trying to help themselves, they get DRs and they go to lockup. So how can the prisoner do it on themselves without the family members helping?
I mean, I've not heard of that. I have not heard of that before. I know that in general you can send legal mail out, but I mean you're talking about mail that's coming in. I mean, there's supposed to be a totally different process for legal mail that's received. It's supposed to be only open in the presence of the prisoner, and they're supposed to sign for it, as opposed to just regular mail. Mail that comes in.
Right. They still do that. I'm speaking of mail coming out of the prison.
Mail coming out?
Going to legal court. Like they're trying to do a motion. They're trying to get an appeal. They're trying to get a hearing. Sending it out to the court, to state attorneys. This mail is not being sent out because guards are opening it before it gets to the mail room, and they are giving them DRs for doing motions on themselves and sending them to lockup, to confinement. I'm talking about.
We have another caller, 215. State your name, please. Hello? Maybe they're just listening. Okay. Finish up with your question, Margareta?
That was it. Thank you.
Well, I would consider to, if there's a, there's a chapter of the local chapter, the ACLU or other legal entity, or I would, even the public defender's office. I mean, nobody's supposed to be getting in trouble based on sending out legal mail. You know, that has to do with access to the court. So, I mean, that would really be, definitely very challengeable for sure.
The
other thing is, if somebody gets written up for that, I mean, that, you know, they should make it, they should send out the, get the copy of the misbehavior report out, send that out. But, I'm kind of like at a loss for words for that. I'm really not sure what to really say because I've never really heard of that before.
No, you know what they're doing? They are doing nationwide in different areas. They are now copying all mail, incoming mail, and they're giving the inmates, the incarcerated individuals, the copies, and they're keeping the original letters. That's incoming mail.
Yes.
I know in Pennsylvania now all mail, if you write an incarcerated individual in Pennsylvania, you have to send it to Florida first. And it goes to Florida. You put the inmate, the individual's name and his ID number in the Florida, and then the Florida address. Oh, in the facility he's in, and then the Florida address, and then it comes. You goes to Florida for whatever reason, and then it goes to the individuals in Pennsylvania. I heard something about legal documents, legal mail. Now something to do with digital. I'm not familiar with digital at the prisons. I guess they have a special place where they have the incoming legal mail. But I'm not familiar with that either, as Jeff was saying. But maybe that's something we can check out next time Jeff comes on the show. But we have about 6 minutes left. So unless this 215 caller wants to say something, we're going to hand it back over to you, Jeff.
Sure. I'll just share in terms of things people can do that benefited me while I was inside. I used to go to the law library all the time, and learn the law and get familiar with the law. I mean, I didn't have confidence for lawyers just to defend me by themselves. So, you know, plus the theory also was, if, you know, is that if there was some new decision that came out in the courts that could be utilized, you know, just that, you know, when there's retro, when there's cases that come out that are retroactive, I mean, that's helpful to know that. So I would suggest going to a law library for that purpose. I used to collect articles about other people who were exonerated, and I would use that as inspiration to keep going and, you know, see, like, who actually helped them, who helped them, what route did they take. So that would be another thing. And take programs that have some potential value if and when you return back to society. So I obtained the GED. You know, I got the college associates in a year towards the bachelor's before the funding was cut. And then I did other vocational trades. I would say the trades I took that helped me the most were typing, because everything now in society is with the computer. And if you can type on the keyboard, that certainly facilitates that. I did general business and computer repair, and I learned how adults learned. And I used to go to a general library as well. And, you know, I would, from 1998 to 2006, I read 3 or 4 nonfiction books a week. So I found ways to entertain myself while also learning something at the same time. I liked reading about governmental abuse expose type of books as well. So those would be my tips. And, you know, avoid the prison politics. I mean, there's very little of what's going on in prison that's, you know, actually important. I mean, you have to stay on point. You have to, you know, you want to avoid, you know, getting in trouble as much as you can. You want to stay out of the prison politics. But beyond that, remember, the big picture is, you know, trying to overturn the conviction, trying to regain your freedom, trying to get back to your friends and your family rather than getting caught up in prison politics. You know, it's very difficult to try to do legal work or work on your case with, you know, if you're in solitary confinement. You know, it's bad enough you're already inside. You don't want to make things worse. Now, I realize a lot of the guards have come into work and they displaced their aggression onto their prisoners, and they're often less than professional. So I understand that things are not totally within the prisoner's control, but there are things that you can do that, you know, can greatly lessen and reduce the possibility. So you can only do what you do, but I think that that's a reason to minimize things. So those would be my really quick tips.
Can you, I didn't bring up your the name of your organization again, but I want you to tell the audience how they can contact you and any of your contact information. And also, if you can make it back next Tuesday, maybe to talk more about these things. But if you can give all your information out right now, I'd appreciate that.
Sure. The name of the organization is the Jeffrey Deskovic Foundation for Justice. The website is www.deskovic.org. Then in terms of other ways to reach me through social media, you know, I do have a public figure page on Facebook, and I'm on LinkedIn and Instagram. So again, my name, Jeffrey, and then Deskovic, DESKOVIC. So people can reach me that way. Yeah, definitely would be willing to come back on. Next Tuesday. Maybe we could do the show. Maybe have a 12:30 start time, because I have another commitment at 1:30. But I would be willing to go from 12:30 to 1:30 next week. Sure.
Okay, that'll be great. Thank you so much, Jeff. And I want to let the audience know, Jeffrey Deskovic went into prison on a wrongful conviction at the age of 16 years old. You heard him today. You've seen how far he's come. For a 16-year-old that was coerced into talking to police officers without his parent, without any adult with him, he went through a lot, and he will be talking more about a lot of these issues every week when he does come on. So I want to thank you, Jeff, so much for coming on, so much for sharing everything you have shared. Margareta, thank you very much for your questions, and hopefully you've gotten some help out of that for your husband. The guest, I don't know who it is, but thank you for coming on and listening. Perhaps next time you can say something, feedback, or ask questions yourself. But again, I want to thank our guest for coming on, and looking forward to him being back next week. I want to join us next week at 12:30 to 1 Eastern Time with Jeffrey Deskovic, attorney who was wrongfully convicted at the age of 16, came out, got his master's in criminal justice, and is now going around the country speaking out and also helping those who are wrongfully convicted. Thank you so much, Jeffrey. Thank you for coming on. Marguerite, thank you for your question and for you being on with us.
Thank you for having me.